So today I want to say a little bit about critical approaches to The Good Soldier. It is a complicated text, rather frustrating text in some respects. I think also a very great achievement. But it's obviously all about opinion, and we'll have a think about how you might formulate your opinion. I want to say something about some of the textual problems in The Good Soldier. I don't mean textual in the sense of, you know, producing a final version of the manuscript or anything like that, which is what we normally think about in criticism with textual problems. I mean the kind of textual disturbances in the novel, the disagreements in the novel. And this is to do with the fact that we have an unreliable narrator in John Dowd. And just to kind of bring it all together, to think about The Good Soldier as a modernist text. What modernist characteristics does it display? How does it fit into our developing view of what modernism is or was? So that's where we're going with this. So I want to start by suggesting that if we're thinking about critical approaches to The Good Soldier, then one really appropriate approach would be the reader response approach. The reader response school of criticism starts from the basis that everybody experiences a text in a different way. It puts the emphasis on the reader rather than the author. So the idea is that the way that somebody from one country might read a text is going to be different from the way somebody from another country reads a text, because they've got different backgrounds, different expectations, and so on. And other factors might include age, education, gender, and so on and so forth. All the various different things that make you an individual can be discerned in the way in which you respond to a literary text. It seems to me that The Good Soldier is one of those texts where you do have to interpret quite radically in some places. And that's because you've got this limited and subjective view of events. Dowd's method, which he confesses to at several points in the text, doesn't he? He says he's approached this in a rather roundabout way. He's trying to remember things. He doesn't know, quite often, the thing that we finished with last week, he doesn't know things. So we're being asked to supply information, to interpret, to shape the narrative for ourselves. That's not to say there isn't a structure. That recurrent device of the 4th of August as a means of patterning the narrative is quite striking. And the argument about whether he decided on the 4th of August before or after the outbreak of the First World War on the 4th of August is one that still carries on. But there was certainly at least one reference to the 4th of August in his initial draft before the First World War. But maybe after that he used it as a date that has lots of resonance. So there is that kind of recurrent mention of the 4th of August as a means of patterning the narrative. All the significant events that Dowd recounts happened in various years on the 4th of August. So if we accept that, that there is some structure, even within the kind of rambling roundabout way that Dowd tells a story, there is still a lot of context and perspective to supply. And that's because all we have, and we'll keep coming back to this, all we have is what Dowd tells us. So we have to interpret what Dowd tells us in order to make sense of it. So here's an example from the novel where Florence discovers that Maisie Maiden, who, like it seems virtually every woman, apart from Leonora, has fallen for Edward Ashburnham. And this is the account of the discovery of her death. I think it's worth just reading through this. So this is Florence coming in, according to Dow, remember. It's always according to Dow. As soon as she came in, she perceived, sticking out beyond the bed, a small pair of feet in high-heeled shoes. Maisie had died in the effort to strap up a great portmanteau. She had died so grotesquely that her little body had fallen forward into the trunk and it had closed upon her like the jaws of a gigantic alligator. And, you know, you read that and I think most people's reaction would be, wait a minute, you know, just rewind that. She's fallen into a giant portmanteau. So this is a huge trunk, the kind of thing that people in those days used when they were travelling. And she's so feeble and weak, apparently, that she can't get out of this giant portmanteau. And she's died. She's been suffocated or collapsed, had a heart attack, whatever it is. It seems utterly bizarre. The other thing that seems utterly bizarre is the way that Dow chooses to describe this. I mean, what do we make of this simile at the end? The trunk has fallen on her like the jaws of a gigantic alligator. It's cartoonish, isn't it? The image that creates is not a solemn one. It's not a sad one. It's describing the death of a young woman here, the tragic death of a young woman. But actually, it feels almost comic. The jaws of a gigantic alligator. Seems like a very curious way of describing this important event in the novel. You'll recall this comes immediately after Leonora has confronted Maisie and sort of boxed her about the ears. And she's gone off to her room, and then this has happened. And the image it creates just seems faintly ludicrous to me. But Dow presents it. I mean, Dow presents everything in this rather deadpan way. You'll recall that at the end of the novel, he gets to a point where he says, "Okay, I think I've told you all the story now. Yeah, I think that's it." And then he says, "Oh, I've not told you about Edward's death." You know, so the one of the key things in the entire story, you know, I've forgotten about that. Oh, I'd better tell you about that at the end. And that kind of bumbling approach to the narrative is characteristic all the way through, as is this sort of non-emotional and, as I say, kind of faintly comic presentation here. So you do have what I might call the mix of the grotesque and the comic. And it's partly also to do with what is apparently Dowell's ability for self-deceit. That, you know, we've talked before about this feeling that you have as you read the novel, that you want to give Dowell a shake, you want to make him realise what's going on. But he doggedly refuses to realise what's going on. And so here's a good example. This is Dow talking about Ashburnham. And at this point in the novel, this is fairly early on in the novel, he's given us enough detail for us, I think, to draw a conclusion about what kind of person Edward Ashburnham is. And he says that he trusts he's not given the impression that poor Edward, interesting use of the adjective there, you'll notice that Florence is nearly always poor Florence. Poor Edward was, I hope I'm not giving the impression that poor Edward was a promiscuous libertine. This is after he's told us all about his adventures with various, you know, colonels' wives and various ladies of good fortune. He hopes he's not given us that impression. Well, actually, you have, Dal. You know, that's exactly the impression you've given us. So now he's contradicting himself. He was not. He was a sentimentalist. And what's the evidence for that? We might interrogate Dal. This is his answer. The servant girl in the Kilsyte case had been pretty, but mournful of appearance. I think that when he had kissed her, he had desired rather to comfort her. Right, okay, so we discover later on the details of the Kilsyte case. This is the occasion in Ashburnham's past, you remember, where he is on a train. He's in a compartment with this servant girl, and she is mournful of appearance, so his response to that is to assault her by grabbing her and kissing her. And she complains, and you know there is a case, a court case following that. And Dal's explanation of that is that this girl obviously should have been grateful for his attention because, despite being pretty, she was a bit mournful of appearance. So he was just trying to cheer her up and, you know, make life better for this young girl on the train. And, you know, I think as we read that, we perhaps think two things. Well, the first is, well, it sounds like absolutely typical behaviour from this this man whose behaviour we've learnt about already seems absolutely typical. And secondly, how can any sensible person possibly accept that kind of explanation, which seems to have been the explanation that he proffered? And of course, because of his position in society, because of his influence, because of the fact that he is actually a magistrate himself, he gets off. From that, he escapes lightly from that assault on this poor servant girl. So in that kind of mixture of the sort of comic self-deceit that Dal puts forward, we gain an impression, don't we, of how reliable Dal is as a narrator. And that impression is, well, he's not reliable at all. And he seems to be contradicting himself at every turn. So Edward, the good soldier, we have a long list of immoral and criminal activity from him. But he's a good person. He's a pillar of society. He's a sentimentalist. Yeah, it's just because he was sentimental that he assaulted this girl. Yeah, this doesn't really, doesn't really stand up, does it? One more example, my favourite example of Dal, the narrator, who presents us with something in this very kind of deadpan way, where we are being then asked to read an awful lot into it. Is this? This is. These are the arrangements, the sleeping arrangements on Dal's honeymoon. So you'll recall that the heart condition, the alleged heart condition, is discovered, and so any sort of vigorous activity that you might indulge in on your honeymoon is not to be countenanced. So they have separate rooms. And what's more, her room is locked. Why? Because she's nervous about thieves. But it's all right, because an electric contrivance on a cord was understood to be attached to her little wrist. So some kind of pulley system. She only had to press a bulb to raise the house. This is going to raise the alarm. With this electrical thing. And I was provided with an axe, great gods, with which to break down her door in case she ever failed to answer my knock after I knocked really loud several times. It was pretty well thought out, you see. Well, obviously, you know, there's a kind of double-edged sword at the end there, isn't there? It was pretty well thought out, you see. The system was pretty well thought out. Well, yes, it is. You know, this kind of elaborate system of electrical contrivances and the axe and so on. Pretty well thought out to enable her to raise the alarm and for him to come dashing in and save her from the thieves. But also, of course, pretty well thought out to eliminate any possibility of his discovering what she's actually about in her room, which is certainly not sleeping and looking after her poor heart. So, you know, this is a classic example, probably the best example, I think, of where we read what Dowell tells us and we have to kind of reread, because we think, oh, come on, surely, you know, you're a man of the world, you know, you're a businessman in Philadelphia, you've gone away to Europe. Surely you don't think that that's okay, you know, that you need to go to those sorts of extremes, even if you accept that she really has got a heart condition and she absolutely cannot go to bed with you. Surely, you know, there's a more subtle way of arranging this than that. And so he presents us, Dowell, with these little gems that we are obviously then meant to interpret. So we are very active readers. Going back to the idea of reader response, we are very active readers in constructing the narrative. So there is, if you like, a kind of duality. There's almost a kind of twin-track narrative going on. Dowell is an unreliable narrator, as we've established, but he's the only narrator. So all the information that we have is what Dowell has told us. So the question then arises, how much do we take of this as written? How much do we take on the surface value of what Dowell tells us? And because of the narrative is so complex, and because there are so many questions to be asked about what Dowell's telling us and how that actually works, if you remember at least two of the editions that are in circulation have got these quite detailed chronologies of the story in order to kind of unpick Dowell's narrative and also in order to highlight some of the inconsistencies within it. So that we're forced as readers into this position of creating our own narrative. And I've mentioned Roger Poole's essay, which is a tour de force, really. I mean, it's a very entertaining piece of writing. And I'm not suggesting that Poole has got it absolutely right. And I think I mentioned last time that Max Saunders has kind of debunked this article. But the interesting thing about it is that what Poole does is take the statements that Dowell makes and then investigates how far they can be evidenced with, you know, using the rest of the text for material. So he almost does a kind of detective job on it. And what he comes up with is a very, very startling alternative version of the text in which Dowell is a scheming murderer in league with Leonora, and that actually those two are interested in gaining lots of money and property, which they do, of course, at the end, and that in order to do this, they have bumped off their respective spouses. And he adduces lots of internal evidence for that. It's a very startling reading, and it's a very kind of extreme reading of what I've been trying to suggest today. That you are, as the reader, you are being expected to create your own meta-narrative. But having said all that, you know, it is a very entertaining piece of writing, and an unusual piece of literary criticism. But it does kind of push this idea to extremes, perhaps. But it does illustrate that the reader has to do a lot of work in this novel, because it's a problematic text. Dowell is our sole witness, and presents himself, or seems to present himself, as this very, very naive duke. Here is somebody who, despite being mature, a man who has apparently been successful in business, but seems to know very little of the ways of the world, and seems to be not very knowledgeable about things. You know, he has that vagueness about where they're going and what they're seeing in Europe and so on. And he's also, you know, completely duped by the other three in, to various degrees in the four-person central characters. So that requires a reader to unravel the sequence of events. And there's also something else going on in there, which is that most first-person narratives, even when the first-person narrator is not a particularly pleasant person, mostly, and I think we've probably all experienced this, reading a first-person narrative, mostly you empathise with that person. You're with that person, because that person is addressing you directly, I suppose. It doesn't seem quite like that with Dowell. We get exasperated with Dowell, and we want to question what he tells us, partly because sometimes it's demonstrably not right, and sometimes because he says, oh, you know, I don't know about that, or have I told you about this, or did I tell you that before? He's constantly qualifying what he's saying. He's constantly reshaping the story as he goes along. So it lacks that. So for the reader, I think it's difficult to empathise, because Dowell is such a colourless, weedy sort of character, really. And the other thing I think that is worth picking up is that opening sentence of the novel. This is the saddest story I ever heard, Dowell said. And it's a, you know, on one level it's a kind of throwaway line. You've got to start the story somehow, and he starts it with this fairly emphatic statement, this is the saddest story I ever heard. But I ever heard emphasises this business about his lack of knowledge. He is a central character, arguably the central character in all of these events. And yet, he's presenting it as a story he's heard. So what that does, as we read the novel, is confirm our impression of Dowell as someone to whom events happen. He's a passive character. Even though he's directly involved in all of these events, he's actually kind of receiving this wisdom. And of course, as we go forward in the novel, what we understand is that he's telling us this now. You know, he has that line about, imagine we're in a room and I'm telling you this story, and you know, we're sitting around a fire and I'm telling you this story. he's telling us this story now, which is based on what Leonora has told him. So we're getting the story actually at second hand, or, you know, third hand, if you like, because it's Leonora's version of what's happened, told to Dowell, which he is then telling to us. So the saddest story I ever heard is an unusual way to start a first-person narrative, isn't it? He's not saying, this happened to me, quite. He's saying, this is what I've heard happened to me, amongst other people. Emphasising then his lack of knowledge and his status as this naive and put-upon dupe. So Dowell's status then, you know, I repeat, he's our only source of information about the nature of these relationships. So perhaps we do have to take some of what he says as with a pinch of salt. He also says a couple of times, why is he writing this? And he seems to be suggesting it's a kind of cathartic exercise for him. He's exercising all these demons that have been building up over the years. So it's almost like writing as therapy, in which case, you know, does he have to be that truthful? Is he just kind of getting all these emotions out, finally having been a rather emotionless character all the way through the narrative? But again, what this brings up is, how far can we trust him? It's an impossible question to answer. It's something that you have to work out as a reader. And it depends on how you perceive Dal and where he is, if you like, on the kind of spectrum of knowledge. You know, how much does Dal know? According to him, hardly anything. So we become the active reader. The way that Dal presents the text, these repetitions, these omissions, these slight qualifications, all of those things make demands on the reader. It means that you have to be very alert and agile as you progress through the novel. And the narrative that you are constructing, and I think you do have to construct that narrative, don't you? Because you do have to... I think it's natural for us to think in a linear sense. We're thinking about a chronology. We're thinking as he goes on, oh, so that happened then. Right, so now we know where he was before that event that he's just told us about. We're thinking that kind of way. And so there are two narratives in competition. There's our narrative as we work it out, and there's Dal's narrative as he tells us. What that produces, though, at one extreme, in Poole's article, he talks about refusals of coherence. So in other words, here's a text where the writer or the narrator tells us that he's going to tell us a story, he's going to give us the facts about these events, but actually he doesn't, and actually there are contradictions within it. So there's a refusal of coherence, according to Poole. And that forces the reader then to become a kind of detective. So I suppose what I'm suggesting here is that the novel places a lot of emphasis on interpretation by the reader. And you are being asked to make some choices about how you consider the behaviour of these characters and how far you can sort of sift through the contradictory evidence that Dal presents us with. So I'm going to move on to say a little bit more about how the novel approaches society and what that suggests about it. Some critics have argued that, you know, this is a kind of dissection of a certain level of Edwardian society and the amorality of that society. So calling the novel The Good Soldier might be held to be ironic. And we've already mentioned last week how that simple adjective good is loaded in the novel. These are good people. He is a good soldier. So I think it's not long into the novel when we discover something about the character of Edward Ashburnham that we might begin to question just how good a soldier he is. He might be a good soldier in a military sense, although even that, you know, he's invalided out with his heart condition. His heart condition doesn't seem to stop him having interesting physical workouts every now and then. So, you know, how far can we accept that? So that's, you know, that's a starting point, perhaps. But calling it The Good Soldier obviously has connotations to do with what Aspenham represents. And of course, he is very much located in the old Victorian and Edwardian Empire version of Britain. You know, he's seen action in India. He's travelled around the world with his regiment. So he does perhaps represent that old world, which, as Ford is writing the novel, is falling apart as the First World War looms and then begins. What it's going to do, and perhaps Ford is aware of this, is to dismantle that world that Aspenham perhaps represents. And so the old certainties are being swept away. And that's something we keep seeing, isn't it, in modernist writing. That uncertainty about the future, which is caused by the dismantling of the certainties of the immediate past. We might ask, because in most novels, if you're presented with certain types of behaviour, then there's usually somebody who is the yardstick for the behaviour that's to be aspired to. But in our four characters, we've obviously got the adulterous and immoral and criminal, in some respects, Edward Aspenham. We've got Florence, deceitful, adulterous herself. We've got Leonora, who actually in some respects is a kind of pimp for her husband and presides over these lapses. And then we've got Del himself, who, you know, to be fair, I suppose, doesn't seem, according to his own account, okay, it's just what he says, doesn't seem to do anything terribly wrong, although he does recount his beating up of the African-American servant early on in the novel, which seems to be unrelated to anything else, and you wonder why Ford has put that in. And of course, he also seems utterly unconcerned when you would have thought. A key event, the death of his wife, is discovered. What's his reaction? Oh, now I can marry the girl, he says, or he thinks. But even that thought is planted in his mind by Leonora. So he seems to be the puppet, almost, of Leonora in many ways. Certainly, there doesn't seem to be a representative of conventional morality. Ford suggested in a letter to his publisher that what the novel was about was an analysis of the polygamous desires that underlie all men. And I think by all men, he probably, you know, if he were writing now, he would probably have written all people. He's suggesting then that this is an analysis of desire. And remember, the subtitle of the novel is A Tale of Passion. Dal is remarkably passionless, isn't he? But there seems to be an overflow of passion in the other characters. So it does seem, according, you know, if we take Ford at face value there, and actually, I don't know if you should take Ford at face value there, because you can see I've artfully done some elisions there, and the actual quotation is a bit more complicated than that. But nonetheless, he does make that assertion that it's about the polygamous desires of people. So if that's the case, then obviously that goes against the conventions of society, the family unit, all of those sorts of things. And certainly if you look at Edward Aspenham's career and Florence's, then you know, that does seem to chime with what Ford says there. So a little bit about this novel representing some modernist concerns. And I'm going to say something about critical views of the novel. Everything in The Good Soldier seems tentative, nothing seems certain, nothing seems definite. And even if you think about the physical location here, Dal and Florence make their escape from America, they elope, because Florence declares this heart condition, she can't get on a boat again, and so there is no way out. So they're kind of imprisoned in Europe. They're Americans abroad, which is a fairly common type in a lot of literature of the time, particularly Henry James. But they remain marginal figures. They're not immersed in European culture at all. They're in Nauheim for the cure for the heart condition, and they travel sometimes to Paris. They travel to various other places, but they remain very much travellers. They remain very much American and not involved with European culture. So they're displaced, and we've talked about how lots of figures in modernist writing are displaced figures, people who are losing their sense of rootedness, their sense of identity. Dal and Florence are arguably like that. The Ashburnhams, similarly, you could argue, are marginalised because their whole persona seems to be associated with Ashburnham's status as a soldier, and their kind of obvious environment would be somewhere in India, in the Raj, in you know, some hill station somewhere or other. The impermanence of the situation is constantly emphasised by Dal in a rather odd way, that he talks quite often about the routine, about knowing how things are going on. He talks about their life as settled. But in fact, of course, it's not settled, because they are travelling to Nauheim and they're staying in a hotel, and then they're moving off to stay in another hotel when they're not at Nauheim. You know, their life is actually a peripatetic life. They are not settled at all. So there's this constant sense of dislocation, of movement, of not actually being able to present yourself as somebody in a particular place and belonging to that place. So just a few critical views then before we finish. Sarah Haslam, who is an excellent writer on Ford, has this to say, which I always think is a really nice description of the experience of reading The Good Soldier. He's not a hospitable novelist, right? It's not a cozy read, is it, The Good Soldier? He's not a hospitable novelist, but a demanding one. Confusion and struggle with one's own memory of the narrative, have I read this already, are the most frequent stakes for readers of this text. And it is that sense, isn't it, that we are constantly kind of recalibrating as we go through the novel. We're constantly thinking, wait a minute, you know, he said something slightly different before that, or didn't he talk about this before? And it's that... it's that feeling that I think she's nailing there. Confusion and struggle with one's own memory of the narrative. I suppose this is why people want to come up with chronologies of this text in order to understand, to unpick what's happened. That indicates, I think, again, a very modernist trait in the novel, which is this refusal to present a packaged, complete story, something, and you could argue that it does have closure. You know, we have At the end, we have the four central characters. Two of them are dead. One of them is remarried. And Dal himself, of course, is left in the in Ashburnham's place, if you like, in his estate, with the now lunatic Nancy Rufford. So in that sense, you know, there kind of is closure, but there are so many questions that remain unanswered at the end that I think you could suggest that this is an example of a lack of closure in the modernist way. Roger Poole, in that very thought-provoking article, suggests that the whole thing is a kind of farcical attempt to cover the tracks of for Dal to cover his tracks. It reeks with improbability. We mentioned right at the start the business about Ashburnham's affairs. What's the point of saying all that if you're then going to say, if you're Dal, well, actually, he was a good and noble man? Well, Poole says that's to discredit him and to show them, you know, sinking into this kind of ludicrous bathos at the end. The mutually contradictory time schemes are something he makes a lot of play of. But, you know, I think other writers, other critics would say, well, this is just Dal not being aware of what he's saying and being confused and, you know, not actually bothering to correct the contradictions, if you like. And at the extremity, he suggests even that Leonora and Dal are actually a couple. And that Nancy Rufford might even be their daughter. That seems to be pushing it too far to me, but it is a kind of extreme example of how ingeniously you might interpret what Dal tells us. I think perhaps a more considered view is Max Saunders, and this is from the introduction to the new Oxford World's Classics edition. He suggests that this is a world of unconsciousness and concealment, and what it does, and he uses a phrase of Paul Ricoeur, the critic, calls it hermeneutics of suspicion. So in other words, a kind of condition where your interpretation is coloured by suspicion at every point. An assumption that what we observe, whether we are reading people or books, are merely symptoms of something else. So that idea of the psychological undercurrents of actions, which we've explored to some extent in Mrs. Dalloway and Harriet Freke, is a major part of how we understand this novel, according to Saunders. So it's about underlying desires, secret motives, repressed thoughts, concealed ideologies. And I suppose that chimes with what Ford himself said about his purposes in the novel. So, to conclude, there are some key modernist characteristics in The Good Soldier. We're presented with a complex, confusing world where nothing is quite what it seems. Characters don't seem to have a kind of fixed morality, a fixed point. They are ever-changeable and presented in such a way. Our narrator is untrustworthy. We can't quite accept everything that he says because he contradicts himself, because he goes back on what he said before, and so on. The lack of linearity, we start at the end and then we move forwards and backwards through the narrative in an apparently random way. Arguably, as I mentioned a minute ago, there's a lack of closure, even though there does seem to be a kind of definite conclusion to the lives of the central characters. But even so, so many questions remain unanswered. And this thing that Max Saunders mentioned, really, it's dealing with complex psychological states, And you could do the same kind of psychoanalytical interrogation of the text as you might have done with Harriet Freke. Harriet Freke lends itself much more, obviously, to that, but it seems to me that these characters are too, the sort of characters that you might want to put on the psychiatrist's couch. I suppose the other thing that's modernist about it is that at bottom, this novel is about sex. And clearly, there are no, you know, there's no kind of explicit treatment of that. But nonetheless, it's about sexual behaviour. And that's relatively shocking, I think, at the time that this was written, and is one of the characteristics of this that makes it perhaps more modernist than traditional at the time. So, thank you very much. We'll see you in seminars.